slipping my mind at this early hour at the moment. This has a kind of Zen-like quality. He says, debts that can't be repaid won't be. And that's what we're dealing with in higher education in general and law school in particular today. Now, the topic of this panel is... I'm doing fine, okay. The topic of this panel is who's the higher ed for the benefit for? Is it for the benefit of the students or the faculty or the administrators? Well, I think we can, I don't know whether anybody's gonna defend the proposition that it's for the benefit of the students primarily today. It seems to me clear that it isn't. Is it for the faculty? Well, I think in many ways it is. Professor Vetter pointed out that faculty are much better compensated now than they were a generation ago. Not usually in direct pecuniary terms, but in terms of other kinds of considerations. You know, teach a lot less, don't have to teach what you don't want to teach, have other kinds of burdensome administrative responsibilities offloaded onto the administrative class, et cetera. But salaries have gone up as well, relative to, certainly to the average American worker, quite a bit. So it's a pretty sweet deal right now for tenured faculty in higher ed and in law schools in particular, although, of course, it's not for the vast army of contingent workers, the sort of precariat, as the new term has it, who are doing a vast amount of the teaching in higher ed, all the adjuncts who are paid almost nothing and have no job security and so forth. It's a good deal, though, very good deal right now for the tenured faculty in comparison to their students, certainly. Now, for the administrators, it's an amazing deal. Just absolutely astonishing. Here, we don't have to get into non-pecuniary considerations. We can talk about the old-fashioned pecuniary kind, which is their salaries, which have gone absolutely through the roof. When I looked into this in the context of law schools, I was agog. I went and I looked up, I'm a graduate of the University of Michigan Law School, and I went and looked up the compensation for its faculty and its administrators 35 years ago relative to today. Now, the faculty are making quite a bit more. In real terms, their salaries have nearly doubled in constant dollars. But the administrators, the dean of the University of Michigan Law School in 1981 was being paid $167,000 a year in 2013 dollars. Which is not a bad salary by any means, but he wasn't being paid any more than the other than the senior members of the faculty. Today, the dean is paid nearly $500,000. The dean of the University of Michigan Law School. Now, look, the last thing I want to be, and I'm sure Dan Polsby will understand why, is a law school dean. That is a horrendous job. I mean, you're dealing with these incredibly entitled, egomaniacal prima donnas who you can't fire. So it's like the worst job in the world. It's all the disadvantages of a CEO without being without the advantages. Now, I understand it's a bad job, but on the other hand, it's not like anybody's drafting you, right? And so if you look at what's happened to the salaries of administrators, they have increased by astonishing amounts. The top paid university presidents 25 years ago were getting paid about $300,000 a year in 2013 dollars. Now we have university presidents that are being paid $2 million a year. And what are they paid for? They are paid to go out and raise money. And why do they have to raise money? Because costs are going up. Right? Now, this can't go on. We cannot have a generation, because let's get back to the generational aspect of this, of indentured graduates who can't get jobs that will allow them to pay off their debt in the long run. This is just not sustainable. So the revolution is coming. I don't know whether it's going to come in, cataclysmic terms or in slowly decaying terms. I don't know whether the creative destruction is going to be all at once or in bits and pieces, but it is absolutely coming because you cannot sustain the economic model that runs law schools in particular and higher education in general in America today. And so that, I think, is what we are talking about today, and I hope we have a chance to discuss it further. Thank you.
Third speaker, Dan Polsby, comes to us from the category of people that have been some of the punching bag of our first two speakers. Dan comes to us as a law school dean for 10 years in the trenches in this time of extreme challenge in higher education generally and law schools in particular. After a distinguished quarter century on the faculty at Northwestern Law School, for some reason, Dan gave all that up and moved to administration when he became dean at the George Mason School of Law. Dan is a very insightful guy and somebody who is known to speak his mind on questions like the ones before us today. And to do so without self-censorship or self-pity or a wish to please. It's my pleasure to introduce, as our third speaker, Dan Polsby.
Thank you, Dean Morgan. Did you know that Tom was dean back in the day? That part of the argument is called ethos. It pains me to say that almost everything that's been said so far, I agree with. I have some reservations about the proposition that all deans are overpaid, but almost all. Let me begin here, but before I get to my main point, we've only got a very brief time. Professor Fetter's topic especially, I just have to dog-ear this for you, okay, because I'm familiar with the turf. That was very dense. There is an awful lot there, and it is terrific stuff. And by the way, some of the stuff that he said sounds pretty hair-raising, but wait till you see it in a PowerPoint slide. Yeah. Okay, it will really get your adrenaline going. So before I get to my main point, I want to begin with three motions in limine. First, in the course of my remarks, I may say some harsh things about academic leadership, university presidents, university trustees, community and political leaders who interest themselves in higher education. Please do bear in mind, won't you, that I am an academic leader myself, although a subordinate and humble one, and I work for others. It would be a disservice to all concerned if you understood the things that I said as being specific to my institution and my bosses and so forth. I'm not a tattletaler. I'm not here to do that sort of thing. We should be so lucky that the problems that we're talking about here today were problems of one school or two schools. They're not. They're cultural problems. They're quite deep. And what to do about them is not a short subject. The second of my motions, I really want to rebuke the premise of this panel entirely. It asks whether the higher education is run for the sake of the people that are running it. Is it true? Are you shocked that gambling is going on in the back room? Isn't this tantamount to asking the question whether human nature has suddenly been put in suspense as far as higher education is concerned? Although it's at large with respect to every single other thing that people do. Folks, I'm not ordinarily, believe me, trust me, an exponent of the philosophy of John Calvin, but on the subject of human nature, I have to admit, he had it nailed. If you gaze into the eyes of human nature, what you find gazing back is total depravity. Calvin thought there was one and only one way to overcome this, as many of you know, sola gratia, by grace alone, or in other words, if you find people who are behaving together in a way that is not comprehensively explained by their basic human depravity, if you find that, it's a miracle. Now, I'm not sure I follow him all the way to that, but I do think that in order to make good decisions, if not miracles, and if not heroism, which is an awful lot to ask as a standard of behavior, that our leaders could profit from a certain amount of what used to be called Romanitas, the stoical, precipitated disinterestedness, courage, clarity about purposes that seems to be in short supply in the current generation of elders. And let me just say as an aside, I hope I don't offend, our parents and our grandparents have been well called, I think, the greatest generation, and for a lot of reasons they probably deserve that. But although with exceptions, on the whole, they were pretty crappy parents. And they cut their kids too much slack. And the world that we live in, I think, is in significant measure a product of that. So I've got a short answer for, is it, who's this being run for? The short answer, duh. And I wouldn't worry about it because, as the Herb Simon aphorism points us to, there are, in fact, exogenous resource-based limits on our rapacity, on our capacity to screw other people. So we need to ask ourselves how we can make the best of things for the public good, given the capacity constraints that our humanity imposes. Are there things that we can do? And that's a real good question. The third motion is, and this, for heaven's sakes, let's not lose track of this. I love reading Richard Vedder's work, but I have to tell you that it points one in the direction of losing track of the main point here. What we do in higher education is really important, and it is really worthy of a lifetime of painstaking. We are, for all of our faults and all of our subtractions and all the lurid stuff you read about in the newspapers and the crazy professors and the nude seminars and all, we are, underneath all that, the treasure house of civilization. Our civilization, all the other civilizations, all the human life that came before civilization, all the geological and astronomical time before that. Okay, that's what we do. Most of that information, knowledge, is not the possession of any one person. Not even making a pencil is, legendarily, right? It is an institutional possession. Pains me to say, it takes a village, a big one, to capture all of that. So what we're doing is important. We're preserving knowledge, we're passing along to the next generation things that shouldn't be forgotten. So even though we professors individually are not big deals, our assignment is a big deal assignment, and when we screw up, as unfortunately we do, usually with a lot of political help, it is a big deal. Okay, it's not like Bill Buckner messing up a ground ball. It's more serious than that. And please remember, a lot of what we do cannot readily be transferred to other venues. Some can be. Okay, if universities disappeared in a puff of smoke, we'd still have the church to remind us about the teaching of Saint Augustine and Aquinas. If universities disappeared in a puff of smoke, the geekly legions, numberless gamers out there would, keep the flame of computer science and coding and so forth going without it. Manufacturing and construction firms would contain an awful lot of engineering, and the reason I know that is that's how my grandpa learned his trade, by doing, and for erudition, his branch of engineering, he was every bit the match of my Uncle Pete, his oldest son, whom he sent to MIT to get that knowledge. Okay, so, but if not for us, we're Where would Geoffrey Chaucer live? Where would Edmund Spenser live? Where would John Milton live? If Plato or Aristotle were to fall in the woods and there were no one there to hear, would there be a noise? You read an awful lot about how we are obsolete. It's time to move on to podcasts or MOOCs. No, baloney. Sorry. Okay, I'm glad I mentioned Chaucer just now because you may remember the wife of Bath's Tale. Her emotions in Limine, and it's called the prologue in her case, were twice as long as her case in chief. So let me get to my case in chief very, very rapidly. Okay, when I was a college student, university leaders were a big deal nationally, much more so than they are now. The winds of change were blowing at gale force. This is the 1950s. We had Nathan Pusey, I believe, was the president of Harvard, James Bryant Conant before that. These are still names to reckon with, by the way. And they were asking, you know, what should education, what should higher education be? Does everybody have to learn Latin and so forth and so on? Conant in particular was a meritocrat, God bless him. He didn't think that the ideal Harvard student necessarily was going to be the son of a previous Harvard student. Let's see those test scores, kids. That's good stuff. These guys knew what they were trying to do. Their successors don't, necessarily because their successors aren't that bright, although in some cases that's the case. But the mission has become more muddled, and that muddle is in the culture. That's not one school or two schools, okay? So take a look at the website of any university, any college, regardless where it is in the country, any market, whatever they think of themselves. What will you find? 50 years ago, we're a good place to get an education, get a job. Nowadays, almost all the schools' websites still mention that, but in every case, they nail the raison d'etre of higher education to what I call the big five: sustainability, diversity, innovation, entrepreneurship, and globalism. They're on every website, everybody doing it. They all come out of strategic plans. They spend a lot of money doing these strategic plans, okay? So what do they have to do with anything, okay? Well, so political correctness takes care of, it's a turnkey answer to that. Okay, of course you need an outpost in Ulaanbaatar. You don't want to be ethnocentric, do you? Of course you need to innovate so all that is old may be new again. Of course you need those electric blue trash cans. Do they have them where you work? Those electric blue, white paper only. Of course they contribute to the educational mission. God knows. Who would dare say that they don't? Case closed. Who would dare say? Who would dare say such a thing? Now, there's something crazy about this, because it really isn't the point. None of this is. If you want a carbon-neutral footprint, is any Michigan graduates here? Oh, go blue. Yeah, yeah. If you want a carbon-neutral footprint, you don't have to wait until 2032 to get it. You can have it by next Tuesday. You can say what Cromwell said to the Rump Parliament in 1653, "You have sat here too long for any good that you have been doing lately. Depart, I say, and let us have done with you in the name of God. Go." If indeed they went, carbon neutrality would be achieved at once. Now, would this be a good thing for higher education? In some cases, yeah, maybe. So it'd take a degree of courage for a university leader to stand up and say stuff like this. And courage is in short supply, and the reason it's in short supply is that political correctness is a capital offense. I'm speaking figuratively here, but maybe if, is Larry Summers here by any chance? Maybe he could. So the point being that the courage that's required is probably more than the courage of one man, but the courage also of alumni and trustees and communities that can stand up and say perfectly obvious, sensible things and not be shouted down by crazies that have been tolerated by the principle of tolerance, okay? So I will wrap up leaving the debt for another day. Gene Meyer, when we were putting this panel together, urged us, don't just wallow in your misery. Tell us how things should get better. Okay, here goes. You ready? Go home. Read Macaulay's Horatius at the Bridge. Report back to my headquarters Monday morning for orders. I think a little bit of Romanitas would go a long way to putting us on the road to where we need to go. So thank you very much.
Well, you've heard three provocative speakers, and one of my jobs as a participating moderator is to try to fill in a couple of the blanks and round out the picture of the panel. I think it may be helpful to our discussion of higher education to put it in a slightly larger context and recognize that what we are calling issues in higher education can best be seen as reflecting changes in the world in which college and law students work. The changes didn't occur in 2008, but what the financial crisis of 2008 led to was a recognition on the part of clients and businesses, employers generally, that they had to get more efficient, more focused on what people were actually contributing to their operations, and to let technology take over many tasks that used to be performed by individuals, and in our case, highly paid lawyers. Clients have relied on more efficient lawyers wherever they can find them, including overseas in some cases, and the reduction in economic growth and thus in transactions and even in disputes left many graduates unemployed. It seemed to universities to be cost-free to basically go with what appeared to be a bubbling economy that was absorbing all their graduates. Was kind of fun to be in higher education in those years. But when the music stopped, as they sometimes say, it became necessary to explore how educational institutions are responding to the changed world in which they work. I agree with Paul Campos on a great many things, but I thought even when he began his use of the term the law school scam. It was probably too early because it seemed to imply more initial knowledge about what was going to happen than was actually the case. Perhaps we should have recognized it, but we didn't. And the question then becomes where we go from here. There has, in the title of the program, there's this issue about whether we're serving students or faculty or administrators. I'd suggest to you that while students have certainly borne a good deal of the impact of the changed world, which they face and higher education faces, that in a sense, they're in the driver's seat. They're the customers of higher education. And there isn't an industry in the country that can afford to ignore the interests of its customers. Higher education operates in an extremely competitive marketplace. Students can choose among over 4,000 higher education providers and over 200 law schools. And students are getting the message of what's happening. The number of applicants to ABA-accredited law schools was about 100,000 in 2004. 10 years later, it's under 60,000, a decline of 40 to 45%. That means students are paying attention, and they are voting with their feet and with their pocketbook. And in a real sense, it isn't the students who are the victims of higher education as much as that higher education is not being responsive to their needs. Part of the problem is excess of information that students have. That is part of the problem that remain. They have so much information, and most of it is bad. They're told on the one hand they ought to go to a local law school or a law school that studies more or teaches more practical skills. Others are told they ought to go to a more theoretical or higher rank law school. They're torn between going to a law school that will that's higher ranked and will charge them more, or going to a school that's lower ranked that'll pay them to attend and to help fill out their class. This produces anxiety. It produces students unhappy with the choices they make. But I'd suggest to you that buyer's remorse, which is part of what we're seeing, is not a long-term institutional problem. It's a problem, it's a transition problem, it's a real problem. But the students are going to come through this remarkably well. Second, the question becomes then among administrators and faculty, who's driving the bus? The answer is often often given is faculty. They demand tenure. They demand low teaching loads to write, as we've heard, unreadable, uninteresting, irrelevant articles. But what this market, what this argument ignores is there's a market for teachers as well. And it may be that universities are simply shopping in the wrong places and for the wrong skills. I'd suggest to you that faculty have essentially lost the market power they unquestionably once had. In the recent accreditation debates before the ABA, faculty fought hard for the retention of tenure or something like tenure. But they ignored or lost on the requirement of a student-faculty ratio, anything like the old days. So the fact of the matter is that law schools, in that case, don't need full-time faculty in large numbers at all. There's nothing about tenure that says you can't increase the teaching load or increase the size of classes. The fact of the matter is that a number of law schools have left 10% or more of their lines unfilled, their full-time lines unfilled, and are simply replacing them, as we've heard, with part-time instructors. That, I'd suggest to you, is the wave of the future. Those lines are today unfilled. They will not exist in the future. And we're going to move more and more in the direction of part-time or shorter tenure, at least, kinds of positions. Law faculty, in short, simply don't have the market power they once had. What I believe is happening, and the people who have the authority today and the power today are the higher education institutions themselves. As exemplified by university presidents or the presidents of standalone law schools, in our case, the rise of what I call the for-profit, non-profit university. I'm not talking here about the literally for-profit schools that Paul has written very eloquently about recently in The Atlantic. Schools like the University of Phoenix or Kaplan University or a group called Infill Law. And I know that profit is a slippery concept in this context. Nobody wants to show a profit if you're a not-for-profit institution. But what I'm describing are nominally nonprofit schools. that make revenue maximization their dominant objective and for whom growth is an institutional mandate for their model to survive. These are the schools that have ballooned in size in recent years because the marginal cost of adding a student is dwarfed by the marginal revenue each of those students produces. In the face of a 40% decline in applications over the last decade, last year over 20% of U.S. law schools actually increased the size of their first year class because of this inexorable drive to increase revenue. I put the blame for this to the extent blame is the right term, and I think it is. I put the blame on central university administrations at those universities, and it's by no means all of them, but it's a large group of them that have adopted this model that worked extremely well in a time when everybody graduated and got a job, worked very well at a time when the cost of borrowing money has been very low. So that these schools, many of them, have become extraordinarily leveraged, as well as dependent on tuition revenue. And the threat to the continued operation of those schools is really significant. A great deal of it, and you've already heard this, is as a result of the federal loan program that makes it appear to students that it is free or at least cheap to invest in education, particularly with the systems now where your repayment rate is based on your income, and if you don't make a whole lot of income over enough years while your life has been chewed up for 20 or 25 years in this state, you can find the loan excused. That kind of attitude has perpetuated the tendency in this direction and has made it, has slowed, I think, the response of universities. One of the things we haven't commented on today, and I'll just comment on in closing, is that we started with the premise that education was a kind of an obligation of us oldsters to the young. What student loans do is shift that. They shift the burden of the younger generation's education to the younger generation and just tell them it's up to you kids. Indeed, the financial advisors will say, don't spend your retirement money putting your kids through college. Let them borrow the money. You can't borrow for your retirement. They can borrow for their education. Perhaps that there's a scenario of the future in which all that will work. But what we have today is a system that has flipped on its head. The idea of what an education is about, who it's intended to benefit, and how well it is succeeding in that process. Now I revert from preacher to moderator again and simply ask the members of the panel to comment on what they've heard from each other. Richard, would you start us off in that process?
Well, I thought I was pretty pessimistic. Paul was even more so. I think that American higher education is in and Paul and I discuss this privately, is going to undergo absolutely fundamental transformation of a major magnitude in the next generation. But what we don't know is when exactly the form of that transformation and the like. What's going on in law schools is now coming to higher ed. Enrollments in the fall of 2014, we don't have the numbers in yet, but are going to be at least 1 million lower for all of higher education combined than they were in 2011. That's 3 years ago. Now, this is not at the magnitude of change that you got at the broader level. But enrollments are going down. Schools are starting to close. One category of schools that are particularly sensitive are in grave difficulty right now, and that's the historically black colleges and universities. They are almost all of them in dire straits. So you're going to start seeing some big changes, and it'll be interesting to see how public policy responds to this change.
Paul?
That's very thought-provoking comments. I want to make a theological point here in response to Dan. I don't think the doctrine of total depravity actually makes any sense, with apologies to John Calvin, because if we were totally depraved, we wouldn't know that we were depraved. In order to have a sense of depravity, you have to have some baseline against which you're measuring yourself, and I don't think we're totally depraved. I mean, after all, we're having this panel right here, right? Why are we talking about this? Why, the first rule of Fight Club is you don't talk about Fight Club, but we're sitting here talking about the fact that this whole system doesn't really work. Even a couple of former law school deans, the people who are like the most reason not to talk about this, are still talking about it. So I want to get a little note of optimism that that some kind of critique is actually taking place, and that change is taking place both for inexorable reasons, but also because people do, I believe, act for reasons not just of pure self-interest. And here, let me just mention one other thing. We have to do something to change a system of evaluation in which administrators are essentially evaluated within higher education on the basis of the metric of whether they're spending more money than they were last year. That's the only way administrators really end up getting rewarded, and that leads to these crazy inefficiencies. I mean, it's literally true within these ridiculous law school rankings that if two law schools were identical in every other respect, the one that spends more money is higher ranked. Which, I mean, is just a recipe, of course, for massive inefficiency and is a perverse, indication of the extent to which, when we're talking about higher education, we're talking about Veblen goods. We're talking about goods that have inverted demand curves. The more it costs, the more demand there is, because consumers will use cost as a proxy for quality in a way that it absolutely should not be used. And we're beginning, I think, to break that pattern of perverse economic and social incentives, but we have a long way to go.
Dan?
What we're dealing with here is a very complicated phenomenon, a very large lading of the problems that we are dealing with in higher education haven't really been generated internally, but have been brought to us by politicians, basically legislators. This is not even meant to be a partisan critique, okay? Because kinder and gentler conservatives are just as guilty as anyone else. The capital structure of higher education is all wrong, okay? And it is not going to be responsive to mere speeches and good wishes. And at least so far, it hasn't been responsive to prayers either. Look, we have $1 trillion now of student debt out there, which is six times more, by the way, than there was a decade ago. That is beginning, trillion is beginning to be a macroeconomically interesting number, okay? As Paul points out, a lot of those loans are non-performing. Well, hello, they're non-performing unsecured debts. They're not performing because basically there were no underwriting standards when they were issued, so that's what you get. What's going to happen? I'll tell you what's going to happen, okay? Congress is going to move in there, and they're going to humanely expropriate somebody in some way, shape, or form. That's actually already begun, and those debts will be paid off. New incentives screwy incentives will be therefore introduced into the system, because people will look around and say, "Wow, it's true. If you really screw up in a big way, they'll have to come to your rescue." Okay, so. that then becomes a cultural attitude. And if I may, the debt problem is not about money. It is about culture. Okay, so you are subsidizing an unproductive piece of your society, but it's at the expense of their productive contemporaries. Okay, so their contemporaries are kids that are going to perform on their loans. They're coming out of school with an unprecedented amount of unsecured debt, things that nobody in this room, unless you were really weird, had to look at, tens to hundreds of thousands of dollars of unsecured debt right at the beginning of their lives, when their animal spirits are highest and their appetite for risk is the greatest. And this is going to suppress, this state of affairs is going to suppress, in effect, the risk preferences of an entire generation. Now, we in this country have made a hell of a profit on the risk preferences of our succeeding generations for the last 150 years, and that's all going to change. It's changing now. Okay, and that's what I mean by it's deep in the culture, and it isn't at this point. I don't think anything that we can fix by getting to right-sizing our faculties and the rest of that. But I'll subside.
Okay, it's now time for you to participate in this discussion. We have a long line already lining up at the center microphone. I think there are others, but we'll start right here. Yes, sir.
Good morning. My name is Mark Pulliam from Austin, Texas, home of the flagship campus of the University of Texas. And if Ann Neal were here, I would direct this question to her. Instead, I guess I'll direct it to Professor Vetter. And the question pertains not to law schools in particular, but higher education more generally. And in terms of how are we going to solve these problems, it seems like the logical source would be the people in charge of governing higher education, boards of trustees, boards of regents, and so forth. And yet, at the University of Texas, Wallace Hall, a member of the Board of Regents, who has asked some of the same questions that these panelists have been asking, in return for asking these questions, has been subject to unprecedented impeachment proceedings. His case has been referred to the Travis County District Attorney's Office to see if criminal charges should be brought. He's been demonized, harassed. What does this mean, and how can we solve this problem if the people in charge of these organizations cannot try to solve the problem without the kind of pushback that he's experienced?
Yeah, the Texas situation is absolutely disgraceful. It is beyond the pale. I would make the general point that trustees, and I would include private schools in this, of universities, on average, are not showing adequate oversight of what's going on in universities. There is the other side, where you have the meddlesome trustee who wants to determine who the next football coach is going to be. That's usually the most important thing. And there is that problem, but it pales in insignificance to the point, to the other side, where trustees and governing boards have been taken over by the administration. They don't get adequate information. They don't know what's going on. Wallace Hall, who I know and have met, and I've been behind the scenes heavily involved in the Texas matter and working with regents to try to affect the change to get rid of Bill Powers, to be blunt. About it, who was what he did with the law school at Texas is another story for another day, but it's scandalous and probably corruption, depravity.
Now that was total
depravity. Yeah. The governance is a serious problem. Who runs the university? Who owns the university? The issue of property rights is interesting here. Who owns the university? And everyone thinks they own the university. The faculty think they own the university. Some schools, the students think they own the university. A few places, the trustees claim they own the university, but if the president told them to go to the tallest building on campus and jump off, they would. And Texas is the absolute worst example. I had a public records request made all my emails. I live in Ohio, by idiots at the University of Texas who were mad because I was saying that Bill Powers is exceeding his, you know, that there's problems down there and the Regents ought to address it. It is shameful. Sorry.
And the issue is more general than Texas is the point. Yeah. Yes, sir.
When I was about to enter college half a century ago, my older members of my family said we could not apply for financial aid because we weren't poor enough. We weren't filthy rich, though, but back at that time, very few people applied for financial aid. Now everybody, except the truly filthy rich, everybody does apply for financial aid. The point I want to make is, it is not financial aid to students. It is financial aid to colleges. Because if all this money were not being handed out, supposedly the students who then have to pay it back over a 20 or 30 year period, if all this money were not being handed out, the colleges wouldn't dare put up their expenses and their charges. They'd have to put it down. Because if they didn't, they would lose 80% of their enrollment. So I think we should call it what it is, financial aid to colleges, and I think that only the truly poor should have financial aid. Let the colleges do with less. They deserve less.
We'll assume that that answered its own question. Go ahead.
Excuse me, sir, there's a second microphone line back here.
I'll get to you in just a second. Let me get this.
So without absolving the faculty or the administrators of the university, I wonder how much blame should lie with parents. And Professor Campos sort of mentioned the issue, but about a year or so ago, I read this extensive interview, forget where it was, but with former GW president Trachtenberg, where he was pretty much asked point blank, how is it that in about 20 years, GW's tuition quadrupled? And he said, well, by raising our tuition to at or past Harvard levels, that sends a message to parents that we are as good as Harvard. Now, leaving aside the question of like the value of Harvard, you know, to the side, but that's kind of, you know, and if that's true, then shouldn't some of this be with parents? And I've sort of experienced it in my own family and family friends who send their daughter they asked my advice and they ignored it, send their daughter to more expensive but kind of brand name school rather than a sort of a less expensive local school that gave her a scholarship because, well, if it charges X amount of dollars and it has a big name and a nice football team, it must be a better school with better prospects now the daughter's graduated. Not so much. But so I just wonder how much we should ask of parents when they make decisions where to spend their and their kids' money.
I'd like to address that. The problem here is a cultural, structural one, so I don't want to individualize it too much by talking about the morals or lack thereof of whether it's the administrative class or the faculty or the students or for that matter, the parents. And the structural problem is this. Higher education in America, to a significant extent, not exclusively, but to a significant extent, is a signaling device. That's what it is. It signals pre-existing abilities on the part of the people who go to school, and it signals the social class of the people who are going to those schools. I speak on this from a perspective which is probably, but certainly different from that of most people probably in this room, which is a sort of left perspective. And I see the sort of left liberal consensus that what we need to do is make everybody a member of a Princeton eating club so that way we can get rid of economic inequality in America is just kind of crazy. The whole point of elite institutions is to be anti-egalitarian, right? I mean, saying, oh, we have to make Harvard and Yale and Princeton more egalitarian is like saying you want to make the French aristocracy more egalitarian. The reason institutions exist is to signal social, differences in social distinction. And if I had a dollar for every Tom Friedman column I read in which supposedly the answer to our problems was to turn everybody into a PhD in electrical engineering or something, I could retire right now. All of that is a misunderstanding of the fundamental function of education in America. So those parents who are sending their kids to schools that are more expensive
are making a mistake to the extent that the expense doesn't actually signal the social distinction that they're attempting to purchase. But to the extent that it does, you know, in that sense, it's a quote-unquote good investment. And if we within the higher education were more candid with ourselves about that, I think we would take a more realistic attitude towards how the system could be changed in ways that are that are less destructive to people who come from less privileged backgrounds and are trying to sort of buy their way into the system.
Richard, you want a quick?
Yeah, a real quick comment. While I think this is the most selfish generation, not the greatest generation right now, I would defend parents in one respect. There is a horrible information college, a problem about higher education. Did George Washington have a good year last year or not? Who the hell would know? How would you know? How do you measure value added in higher ed? How do we know what the graduates make 5 years after graduation? Do we have any good information on this?
No.
No. There's a lot of mystique. We have rankings. I do one. I do the Forbes rankings myself. I'm in the rankings business, and the rankings are imperfect, very imperfect, but they're at least an attempt to try to provide information. Why don't we get better ways to provide information? The colleges don't want it, because they don't want, George Washington doesn't want to be compared with Georgetown, or the University of Colorado doesn't want to be compared with whoever. No, I'm picking on Colorado. It's a great school, by the way. So there is an information problem.
Over here, yes, sir.
The title of the panel focuses on faculty, administrators, and students. It does not mention the employers of law school graduates, who I think in a way are the ultimate customers of what law schools offer, because most students go there to get a job, and they would not be hired unless somebody wanted to hire somebody with the skills they learned at the law school. So my question to the panel is, where do you see the employers of law school graduates fitting in this? What are they telling the schools that they want to see in their graduates, and what, if any, reforms may be underway or to move in that direction?
Dan, can you?
It's a very perceptive point. It really isn't right to say that the students are the customers. They're not. They're the product. Okay, the customers are the people that are going to employ them, the employers. What we hear from the employers basically is, students need to write better, okay? And a generation ago, they wrote better. Why did they write better a generation ago? Because they wrote more in elementary school and in high school, and they had students, women basically, that were locked out of other avenues of employment, really smart ones, sometimes pretty mean too, if I remember rightly, who were making them write and correcting them and the red pen and all the rest of that. There's very little of that now, so the writing skills are relatively weaker, and the employers notice, and they're honest about that. As far as the skills training piece, which is what the vast majority of the journalists write about, that is a generation old news, okay? That they were already doing skills training and more skills training back starting around 1970, okay? So there's a lot of that, and kids get that. It's the writing piece, because that becoming a virtuoso writer is something, it's a lot tougher and takes a lot longer than becoming a virtuoso in the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. It's like learning the piano. It takes years.
Roger?
Roger Pilon with the Cato Institute. I'd like to pose to the panel a not entirely rhetorical question. Namely, Dan Polsby urged us to think about this issue in much deeper terms. Isn't the problem before us that perhaps that we live in a society in which we want all of our children to be above average?
Richard, you want to start with that?
Seems well, I think the answer is yes. It's a Lake Wobegon environment we're in. Everyone wants to be above average. The comments on elitism I thought were particularly
perceptive is the word you're
protective. Yeah, incidentally, when I get a bunch of left liberals together and I want to get them all riled up, I said, why don't you go after Harvard? I mean, if you want to talk about elitism at its finest, at the intellectual aristocracy of Harvard, Yale, and Princeton, why don't you go after them and start taxing endowments? Remove tax exemptions. You know, go to where the elite really are if you really want an egalitarian society. And none of them, of course, jump to that because they don't want to change things.
Paul? I think from a perspective which is interested in more social egalitarianism, the idea that you have to have a college degree to have like a decent livelihood is an incredibly pernicious one. Because, again, to the extent that higher education becomes universal, it's going to have to be devalued. You know, we can't pretend that everyone is capable of doing the kind of work that is recognized as valuable academic work within a liberal arts context or some other context. And what's happening is because everybody needs to be above average, we're just watering down what average means. I mean, you see this in law schools, basically the grading curve just keeps getting bumped up like every 5 years because of this kind of Gresham's law where we have to like, you know, what used to be a C+ is now a B+ because we have to pretend that everybody's really, really good at whatever it might be. And Dan mentioned, you know, that employers say, well, we want people to be better writers. So I've been a legal academic for 24 years, and for the life of me, I don't know how you turn a 25-year-old who's not a good writer into a good writer. That's one of those sort of miracles that we're supposed to perform in higher education, even though there's no basis for thinking that's even really realistically possible if you consider declining marginal utility, you know, and in education. I mean, taking a 5-year-old and turning that person into somebody who can read is an incredibly valuable kind of thing to do socially. Taking a 25-year-old and turning them from a mediocre writer into a really good writer in what? A 3-month legal writing class? How is that supposed to happen? I have no idea. But, you know, I realize that people in legal academia have to talk as if we can do that all the time in order to justify the enormous expenditure that goes into this entire operation.
Dan?
There is a way. It's the same way that you get to Carnegie Hall. Practice.
Yeah.
Question?
Yeah, Brian Bishop from the Stephen Hopkins Center for Civil Rights, and I wanted to commend to Dan, and actually it follows on Paul's point, but to anyone in the audience whose forebears perform quite well with on-the-job training, the work of Mike Rowe of Dirty Jobs fame, who now has an organization called ProfoundlyDisconnected.org, which is working on just those questions of whether a college degree is the right way to have a dignified work career, and he also charges anybody who would work in the trades as I do to have a commitment and a work ethic, not an entitlement. But my question is, back on the parents' question, education. I know from Rhode Island that slaves paid Quakers to educate their children. So that people in the most mean of circumstances saw that as an important investment. Now, where education has been, you know, egalitarianism in a way has come to education, I think do you think, this is supposed to be a question, that this has attenuated parents seeing that something actually comes from the education besides the job or status afterwards, but the actual idea of being educated? I feel that's greatly attenuated.
Dan, do you want to get in on this?
I wasn't sure what the question was.
Well, I mean, I'm asking, like a parent, and you would think this mattered more, and you know that you want to make sure your kids can read when they're going to, and maybe you still care about that, even though the public is paying rather than you. But when parents paid more directly for education, I think they cared that the kid was studying and not drinking, or at least that, you know, that they exerted an out loco parentis on that higher education experience.
It's hard to know. You know, back in the day, colleges and universities purported to act in loco parentis with respect to their kids, and fathers were downright paternalistic.
Yeah.
neither is true now, And, you know, exactly where you grab the thread to re-ravel it, that's beyond my pay grade.
I think we can get a couple more questions in before we have to break up.
Hi, Matthew Sommer from Harvard Law School. I have a question for Professor Vetter. You very heavily implied in your remarks that the only value from a college education comes in future pecuniary gain, and I want to challenge that a little bit. Don't you think that, one, is a society we're better off with more people educated? Isn't the society where even the taxi cab drivers have college degrees better off than the society where they just have driver's licenses? Especially in a democracy where an educated citizenry is our
Depends upon what the taxi driver majored in.
And obviously we don't want people with debts they can never pay off. But isn't it better that people have student loan debt as opposed to credit card debt or gambling debt?
You're asking a very important question, actually. Is college just about earning and earning? Is it all just an investment in human capital? And the whole purpose of public subsidies of education is based on ideas, as economists say, that there are positive externalities or spillover effects to higher education. The issue is, are there, and how big are they? And are they getting bigger or smaller with the passage of time? We all agree that higher education, there's a socialization dimension of higher ed. Going to college and having fun isn't in itself bad. There's nothing wrong with having fun.
But not just having fun, I mean.
Yeah, no. But getting to your point, I asked Milton Friedman this shortly before he died. Milton Friedman in Capitalism and Freedom said, well, we should subsidize universities because universities do have these positive spillover effects. If we all learn, we're going to commit less crime, and we're Gary Becker argued this. We'll commit less crime, we'll do, we'll smoke less, there will be lower Medicare costs as a result, blah, 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 blah. But shortly before he died, I asked Friedman, do you still believe this? And Friedman wrote, he says, there are negative as well as positive externalities to higher ed. And he says, it is an interesting empirical question whether we should be subsidizing universities or taxing them. you have a point, but that's all I can say.
Good. One more.
All right, Nick Chidiak, I just graduated from law school this year. I want to assure the taxpayers in this room that I will start paying off my student loans this month, and we'll pay them to completion. I also discomfort them that many of my friends and peers borrow the maximum amount, knowing that given the structures and some of the pay-as-you-go structures that they will not have to pay all of it back. So I have two questions. The first is, we've talked about the explosion in the number of administrators and administrators' salaries. I wanted to first address how much of this is from political pressures of both political requirements that are requiring needs for administrators to address in these roles, and salaries, because administrators who handle the political side is becoming an incredibly valuable skill. Second question is, we have an incredibly cheap credit for cheap and readily available shall issue loans for student debts, but for all of these, whether it's some of Mike Rowe's efforts in the different trade schools, some of the programming boot camps that have developed, access to capital for young people in this regard is virtually nil. And I was wondering, should we sort of adjust that to widen that a little bit? Or is the absence of banks that work with young people and helping them finance their training a reason why there's not a functioning credit market there?
Paul?
I think there's a lot of misunderstanding about the role of private lending in higher ed. Private lenders are dying to get back into higher ed because they see it an extraordinarily profitable market because of so many sort of cultural distortions that people are so desperate to, send their children to school and therefore will borrow large amounts of money to do so. So I disagree with people who say, well, we can fix all this by getting the government out of higher ed lending. I don't think that that's true. I think that the government does play in some ways a pernicious role, but it's the problem is certainly more general than that. As to the question of administrators, I think there are more administrators because there can be there it's true that there are more governmental requirements and those sorts of things that have to be fulfilled, but all of that money has to be spent. The amount of money that pours into higher education in America every year is absolutely
astonishing, and not just from tuition and not just from federal loan programs, but just if you look at the endowments of like the richest universities and colleges in this country, it's absolutely astounding. I mean, how is it that you can deduct money that you give to Harvard University from your taxes? When you think about that, that is absolutely crazy. I mean, here's an institution that has a $40 billion endowment that could basically just light money on fire all day. In fact, it does do that pretty much, and never run out of it, right? And you get a tax deduction for giving these people money, right? And then everybody else says, "Oh, we have to be like Harvard because why? Well, because Harvard's the best or whatever, and so we have to ape their mores and their financial structure, and that leads to this catastrophe that we're dealing with right now."
We are indeed facing a crisis. I don't think there's any other way to put it in higher education as we try to restructure and reorganize this essential aspect of our economy and our society. We appreciate your attention here this morning and wish you all the best for the remainder of the convention.